Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheese making craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
I'm Lou Bank.
And I'm Greg Benson.
And this is an ad for Ancestral Agave Syrup, the critically acclaimed award-winning syrup that helps gringo bartenders better make margaritas, Negronis,
Lou, hold up,
old
are you just
fashions?
This is how you start your podcast.
What?
It's not an ad for Ancestral Agave Syrup.
Well, of course it is. I'm just cutting costs by not paying writers to make something new. I'm just using an old script.
You pay writers?
That's some kind of jab?
No, I'm just saying
What are you saying?
Well, look, we've got this amazing syrup that's made in an ancestral manner, cooked down from the sap of the agave, harvested the way these families would to make pulque. It's a quality product. It deserves a quality presentation.
Yeah, okay, hang on. Ancestral agave syrup is made by real families following traditional methods. Unlike the industrial Blue Weber syrup you get everywhere else, Ancestral is cooked down from agua miel harvested from Salmiana in Hidalgo, Mexico. It is the grade A Vermont maple to the sticky diner syrup you've been using for your cocktails. Ingredients matter, both in how your cocktail tastes and how you treat the earth. Ancestral is better for both. Is that good?
Sure. Or maybe confusing instead of cheesy. Look, just visit ancestralagave.com to learn more and to order your world-class agave syrup today.
And we'll call that a wrap. Catch you next ad, Greg.
Hasta pronto?
Ancestral Agave Syrup, available online at ancestralagave.org and wherever Greg and Lou were able to coerce store owners into carrying it.
I'm Lou Bank.
I'm Ron Jacobson.
And this is Agave Road Trip, the critically acclaimed award-winning podcast that helps Gringex bartenders better understand agave spirits and rural Mexico. And Rowan Jacobson, I am so excited to have you on Agave Road Trip. This is actually going to be the way that things fall. I think the second episode you'll be on, but it's the first one we're recording.
Right.
So I feel like I have to welcome you.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, I think.
You know, I reached out to you when I read your 2010 book, American Terroir. I reached out to you because the chapter that you wrote about maple syrup got me so excited. The way that you were writing about the smoke and the smells and late at night, it reminded me so much of being in a palenque in Oaxaca drinking mezcal. And I sent you an email and said we should still do that sometime, where we're just drinking mezcal and eating the cooked down sap of the maple in one of those.
Yeah. I mean, like, you're the first person I ever heard say that. But then once I was down there in Mexico, at visiting all these palenques, I was like, wow, like Lou nailed it. Like, it's the same thing, right? Like, different raw material, but the like, there's all these same sort of traditions around it. It really is that they're like, you know, separated at birth, twins in some ways. It's funny.
And you were regretting not bringing some maple syrup with you to the palenques?
They always take it away from me, you know, at security in the airports.
Carry on syrup. They might have pancakes on the plane.
You never know.
So you and I were just traveling through Mexico a few months ago, right? And it was part of the research that you were doing for a piece you're writing. Are we allowed to say who you're writing? Of course we're allowed to, because by the time this airs, it'll be out. what am I thinking? there you go. Well, no, not even hopefully, right? I won't air this until it's ready to go.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, then.
Yeah, I don't spill the beans. There must be some kind of term you professional writers use for this. Piss off your editor?
No, there is a word.
Embargoed?
Yes, thank you. Very good. Yes.
Look at that. So, yeah, so it'll air then. So if you're listening to this, you already know that because it's already aired. It's already in print. So you're writing a piece that you described to me in an email as a sustainability feature on Mezcal for Bloomberg's Business Week. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you wouldn't let me read an advance copy because you're professional.
Well, yeah, you should. Well, every single magazine contract has this, you know, clause in it that you will not show this to your wife or anyone else.
Your wife, really? Well, it doesn't literally say that. It just says everybody.
Yeah, anyone other than the people of the magazine. Like, that's just been a standard clause in those contracts for years. And as the world of writing has become more corporate, I've like paid attention to the contracts. I'm like, okay, they actually mean this stuff.
They hold you to it. Well, so I would love, though, to have a conversation with you about what you found and about, I guess, just in general, your thoughts on the directions that you think Mezcal and biodiversity in Mexico are headed based on what you saw.
Yeah. And, you know, like what I saw is only obviously one small sliver of the whole thing. But yeah, and I am, you know, the hundredth or thousandth person to sort of like put two and two together and come up with the same answer. But when you look at Mezcal's exploding popularity and just the life cycle of the agave plant, that stuff that you guys have talked about on the show quite a bit, and just the nature of making mezcal, that like every plant is one and done, you kind of go like, wow. And so much of it is still coming from a wild harvest. You kind of go like, can this be sustained, and what needs to happen for this to be sustained, or the wild plant's just going to disappear? And, you know, it's gonna, yes, there's going to be a cultivated espadine, but is that going to be it, or whatever else they can cultivate? So those are the questions. And like, you know, we got to visit a few different people who are addressing that question. And I visited some more. So how do you sustain that, this kind of thing, with these very unusual variables that are involved in it?
Well, so let me ask, and those are the questions, right? But let me ask you, did you find any correlation between what you saw in Mexico and what you experienced down in the Amazon for your podcast? Look at this. I'm going to give a little shout out to your podcast, Wild Chocolate. When you went to look at the families, the communities that are harvesting cacao in the Amazon, did you see any correlation there?
That's an interesting question. Maybe a reverse correlation.
How do you mean?
Because cacao trees, you don't kill the tree, right, to get the cacao, right? You pick the pods. So the more market demand there is for wild cacao, the higher the value is on protecting those trees. Like, suddenly, they're worth more money than cutting it all down for a cattle ranch. The problem with agave is the more market demand there is to whack that plant, you know, the more the plant gets whacked. So then I think the question becomes, how do you, like, actually, I know, like, you know, what you've argued that, and rightly, that it's very expensive. If this is a very valuable plant, right? If people are paying a lot for mezcal made from a wild variety, that's good. You want that value. But for the wild crop, you know, it becomes another, like ginseng or bluefin tuna or whatever. Like, how do you just, tragedy of the commons, like standard tragedy of the commons. So then does it have to all become cultivated, right?
Right.
Like, so unlike cacao or anything where you're just harvesting the pods, I think it just ends up being cultivated or gone, probably.
You know, and I think that's right. And I think that's part of the, part of my frustration is we don't talk specifically in this conversation about do we want to preserve wild land, including the wild agave, including the wild insects, including the wild animal, all the wild stuff, right? I mean, I love agave, but it's not everything. Do we want to preserve that? Do we want to preserve the wild, or do we want to preserve specific species of plants through farming? And I think we're getting to a point where we really have to make that decision.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, and of course, like, what makes this interesting is that it hasn't happened yet. Like, it's so rare to have, like, a significant industry working off of a wild resource, especially on the land. It never happens. Like, there's still some, you know, sea fishing type industries that use wild resources, but so rare to have one that's still growing on the land. So what's so amazing about Mexico is that it's still working. Like, you know, in the U.S., all our food and drink is coming from things that we pretty much wiped out in the wild and are only cultivating. So it's only an issue in Mexico because they still have it, you know, because they haven't killed it yet.
Oh, you know, that's really interesting. So, you know, this takes my head in a completely different direction than I imagined it would go in. So, you know, when I look at the numbers, Rowan, from Comercam or the CRM or whatever they're calling themselves now, and I see that something like 91% of all mezcal is made from either 100% farmed espadine or somewhere upwards of 80% farmed espadine. And farmed espadine, but then the other percentage is farmed something else, right? And then you've got the farmed cupriata out of Michoacan, and you've got the farmed cenizo. Like, I'm not saying that none of what's being sold in the industry is wild. Certainly some of it is. But I think it's a really tiny portion, and that takes my head to this whole foraging movement. And I understand your pieces about sustainability, and I certainly want to have that conversation, but I think there's also something to be said for why there's appeal in a restaurant that serves you food made from foraged ingredients. I think there's a correlation between that and between drinking wild agave that I'm gonna just throw this out as a theory. And again, didn't think of this before we started recording, but I wonder if that in itself can't be a lens into which we see the importance of saving wild land.
Yeah, like, for sure. And with the foraging movement, I think you're right. Like, it helps introduce people to it raises the value of the wild in a sense for people. Like, yeah. People always have,
God, which is actually, I'm sorry, clearly I'm not so sorry that I did interrupt, but this again brings me back to your wild chocolate podcast. I've been so obsessed with chocolate for a couple of years, and it was, your podcast cost me so much money. I ended up buying so many wild harvested bars, right, from Caputo's. For exactly that reason, without even realizing it until just now.
Right. But yeah, you know, when, like, I do a lot of mushroom foraging in Vermont. Again, it's one of those things where, like, all these forage ingredients, it's if 10 people do it, it's great. If 10 million people do it, it doesn't work.
Right. You end up turning it into exactly the industry that's the opposite of what you want. We somehow, like, there's that piece, that communication piece that's missing in there of, I like this, instead of I like it, I want it. We need to have, I like it, I want to preserve the way that this thing grew, which is the wildland.
Right, right.
How do we do that, Rowan?
I don't know. Does it mean regulations? God forbid, like big R.
Right. Well, you know, that I'm glad you said it that way, because regulations, every time I look at a regulation, I see that the corporations figure out how to leverage it. And it's the small families who end up losing their cultural heritage.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, regulation, they're great. They're great in theory. And then they always, and I'm sure everyone in Mexico would tell us that they have not been pleased with the way the regulations have gone so far. Right. Or not everyone, but a lot of people.
Yeah, enough people. Yeah, you know, I think it's almost like regulations won't work. They'll do the opposite in most cases, in my experience. But I wonder if the answer isn't just to get. Yeah, okay, I'm going to take us in a weird place now. Like, I wonder if it isn't peace and love. I wonder if it isn't the 1960s peace and love movement that we got so sarcastic about in the 70s and 80s and, you know, on to today, that we need to really fall back in love with the land and recognize that that damaging it means that we are damaging our home.
Yeah, yeah. Or, yeah, I don't know. I feel like...
Did I scare you with peace and love? You live in Vermont, for God's sake.
I mean, no, I'm all about peace and love, but... I'm not sure that the boomer generation, the peace and love didn't stop them from like turning into consumption monsters.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's right, but I think that's the thing to solve. I think if you think about our behavior patterns as sort of, instead of being a swinging pendulum, sort of an upward spiral. Mm-hmm. Right. That, well, or like a screw where you got a little bit of the down. I mean, you know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Think so.
Like, I think that we do it again. We head towards that direction again. We're going to fall backward a bit, but maybe our backwards fall isn't as bad as it was after the 60s movement. Maybe, you know, in 2030, things are looking better. And then 2040, we get sarcastic and snarky, but not as sarcastic and snarky as we are now. And you know, you go back and you look at like television shows and movies from the 40s and 50s and how they represented people of color. And those were the standard movies. God, you know, I every year I go and I watch It's a Wonderful Life. And you know, I'm friends with a young man of color. And I took him one year and I'd never even really noticed it. But you only really see black people in that movie when the town goes to hell after he's dead. Right. It's gambling and it's drugs and. And, you know, and so I think we're better than that now.
Yeah.
And maybe progress
does happen. Yeah. And you don't realize it, like you're saying, until we do get better at some of this stuff. This is also taking us way, way down a sidetrack. But
this isn't all in your article, right?
you've seen those projections of population, right? World population, where we're actually going to peak, right? Like everyone worries about numbers exploding, but. Right around, I don't know, like 2090, 2100, we peak. And then it just goes off a cliff on the other side because of demographics. Like we're headed right back to like 1 billion, 2 billion, the way things are going.
Another dark ages. I actually haven't, I don't look that far ahead, Rowan, because I don't figure I'm going to be around.
Yeah, right, right. But no, there's like demographers are in a panic about population collapse, right? And like, aging societies and how do we, how do we deal with that? But I actually, I do think there's a potential golden era where pressure like eases off because all these countries' populations are starting to decline. At the same time, we've made the progress on all kinds of social environmental issues that you're talking about. Could be a total golden era where those things combine and, as long as we can figure out sort of like the economics of how, when you don't have growth, like how that works for everyone flourishes without growth, which that's what freaks out the economists. They haven't figured that one out. You could be, it could be this like golden era where everybody can, you know, drink wild agave and eat bluefin tuna. And there's still, but then there's still lots of them.
God, actually, that sounds like a really good combination to me. I like that combination.
Yeah, well, we need to talk about that in your next episode.
But
that is a good, I do think that's a good one. Sushi.
Yeah. Hell yeah. And I'm sorry, in that year, you think the golden era they're projecting, I just want to figure out how much longer I have to live.
That's why that's the problem. It's a little too long for most of us.
Well, if I keep eating right, do my gut crunches, don't cross the road when there's a car making a left, I should be okay, right?
Yeah, just don't walk. That seems to be the dangerous thing.
Well, you know, before we wrap this up, Rowan, I'd like to just like get one more thought from you about the things that you saw. Was there one big takeaway of everything that you visited? Where it gave you that sense of hope for the future.
Oh man, yeah. All right, I can find a yes on that one. The younger generation that's like super excited about Mezcal, like you know the kids of a bunch of the current Mezcaleros, and then other you know. People I met in their 20s or 30s who are super into it. And like maybe a little while ago, they would have just headed for the States, you know, to send remittances back. Now they're like staying. They want to have their own little palenque. And I think there is like, the cultural part of it and maybe even the economic part of it seems pretty healthy for just the average young Mexican guy coming up.
Huh.
Or young Mexican girl. So, yeah, I feel like culturally it's in a pretty good place, maybe.
Okay.
As long as the raw ingredients keeps coming.
And then you have to cook them so they're not raw. But yes, I hear all of that. And I think that honestly, I think it's a beautiful point to wrap on because you're also, when you're looking back at the kids, that again to me, the kids, the 20s and 30s, that again to me is going back to the whole peace, love movement that we need more of. It's always the kids, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, right on. Cool. Well, thank you very much, Rowan, and I will catch you next episode.
See you soon.
You've been listening to Agave Road Trip, the critically acclaimed award-winning podcast that helps Gringex bartenders better understand agave, agave spirits, and rural Mexico. We're blessed with sound engineering by Roy Sierra and a theme song performed by Gabriel Oliveira and Marco Ricos. Sign up to become a road tripper and listen to more episodes at agaveroadtrip.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please let us know. And if you hated it, well, I'm sure you'll let us know that too. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Agave Road Trip. Agave Road Trip is a production of 10 Angry Pit Bulls, Inc. Agave Road Trip is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. To subscribe to the Heritage Radio newsletter, enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with Heritage Radio Network on Instagram and Twitter at @Heritage_radio. You can also find Heritage Radio Network at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization using the power of educational storytelling about food to build a more equitable, resilient food system. Heritage Radio Network couldn't do that without support from listeners like you. Become a part of the world's most innovative community today. Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the Heritage Radio Network family by becoming a member. To become a member of the Heritage Radio Network, click on the beating heart of our homepage. Heritage Radio Network can become addictive. Programming you hear on Heritage Radio Network might lead you to eat, drink, and listen to more programming on Heritage Radio Network. If you drink, please do not drink and drive. Drink responsibly, drive responsibly, eat responsibly too, and listen to Heritage Radio Network responsibly. To listen to Heritage Radio Network responsibly, wear protective earbuds. While wearing protective earbuds, do not drive. Do not walk either. Sit in a comfortable chair. If that comfortable chair has a hard seat, please remember to stretch every 30 minutes. If you stretch every 30 minutes, please stay within your defined stressing capacity. And consult a doctor who specializes in stretching. If you don't have a doctor, maybe Dr. Ryan Acock, the Cocktail MD, can help you out. Thanks for listening.
Agave Road Trip out.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food. including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.